You're listening to an LA Kings podcast. For more episodes of this and every other Kings program, visit lakings.com/podcast.
You're listening to All the Kings Men, the official podcast of the LA Kings. Now, here's your host, Jesse Cohen.
Welcome back, Kings fans. I am Jesse Cohen. This is All the Kings Men, presented by Manscaped. Manscaped is an official partner of the LA Kings. Thanks to this revolutionary company, manscaping accidents are a thing of the past. Just get yourself the Manscaped Perfect Package 3.0. Inside, you'll find products like their Lawnmower 3.0, which is advanced skin-safe technology, so this trimmer won't cut you. Everything you need to keep trimmed and smelling nice is in the Perfect Package 3.0. You can get 20% off plus free shipping with the code KINGSMEN at manscaped.com. That's manscaped.com, and use the code KINGSMEN. You guys, the NHL entry draft has been moved up a few days. The first round will now take place on Tuesday, the 6th of October, with the remaining round taking place Wednesday, the 7th, where, barring any trades, the Kings will have 3 picks in the second round, 2 picks in the third, 2 picks in the fourth, and then 1 each in the 5th, 6th, and 7th. In today's episode, we're going to be focusing on USA Hockey's National Team Development Program. First up, the Assistant Director of Player Personnel, Rod Braceful, talked to Jack Jablonski about which NTDP players might be available to the Kings in those later rounds. And then the conversation that Zach Dooley and I had with new Ontario Reign head coach John Robleski a few weeks ago for the Rainy Day podcast, which, if you're not already subscribed to, you really should be. And you can do that by going to lakings.com/podcast. Here's Jack and Rod.
Joining me now is the Assistant Director of Player Personnel for the United States National Team Development Program, Rod Braceful. Rod, how are you and how are things up in Michigan at the program?
I'm doing well, Jack. First and foremost, thanks for having me on. Things are just getting going here. So all our players reported here yesterday evening, and we're kind of going through protocols and meetings and kind of showing them what the new normalcy would look like for our returners. And then for our 17 team, they're all brand new. So they're kind of getting accustomed to, you know, that what we have to do to kind of keep making the step, taking the steps forward here for the season.
What are some of those, you know, new norms that you guys are going to have to accommodate to with COVID this year?
You know, guys taking surveys every day. They wake up in the morning at their homes, coming in and having to do constant protocols and checks and just making sure that we're not crossing a lot of paths, walking in one way, out of another way, not having them all kind of run around the building. You know, typical challenges that I think a lot of people have to do right now. The school piece is going to be a little different because, like most places here in Michigan, the school is a little bit online and then a little bit in person. And some districts have actually gone online until kind of the winter. So they're online all fall.
Okay, got it. And now, before we get into the numerous, you know, NTDP prospects of this upcoming draft, I would love your perspective on, you know, what the Kings organization is getting in, you know, former NTDB coach and now newly signed Ontario Reign head coach John Robleski.
Yeah, no, you know what? I think it's a great hire. Obviously, I'm biased. I've gotten to work with them here. But honestly, I would say that they're getting someone that truly cares. He's dedicated. He works hard. And he's going to make sure that he provides the best for the players. I think that in the American Hockey League, you're getting guys who are high-end picks, and you're getting some guys who have a couple-year pro. But the biggest thing is it's a development league, something similar to what we're doing here at a larger scale. You're developing guys to have an opportunity to play in L.A., right? Whether it's from injuries or whether they're younger guys who are – the next generation players. So I think that his expertise in that has been great. And he's going to be able to adjust really well.
If you go back two seasons, you know, Robo coached the 18 team in terms of the team that consisted of, I believe, 16 draft picks and 7 first rounders last year. This past year, he coached the U17 team. So he wasn't involved with these draft eligible prospects. With that said, you know, how much interaction did he have with this year's, you know, team in terms of the U18s and the crossover of which he was probably able to see them firsthand?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. 17 total NHL picks, 8 in the first round. But no, I think that, you know what, we're two teams here, but we're under one roof. And the coaches collaborate a lot. The player personnel and the coaches collaborate a lot. And then one of the best parts we have in our development program is we also have the coaches combine practices at times. So when you kick off the year, just like we're doing now, you know, each team will have their individual practices, but the teams will play against each other. So the O1s played against the O2s. And then after that, a couple of times we mixed it up where you had half O1s and O2s playing against half O1s and O2s.
Okay.
That's the beauty of having 43 players here in our program. So, you know, the coaches collaborated a lot, and I think Robo got to see those O2s quite a bit, even though he was coaching the O1 team. And then for the U18 Worlds, there's opportunities at times for O2s to get called up to participate in that tournament. So some O2s, you know, got called up, and even though they didn't play in the tournament, they got to practice and whatnot. So, you know, I think that there's definitely a lot of familiarity there.
A lot of overlap, actually. And speaking of overlap, you know, if you look at, you know, the CHL with all the Canadian junior leagues, they have a lot of competition, and, you know, it's a good understanding of what each league provides, and you're able to evaluate those players. You know, for you being in the national development program, you know, you play teams from the USHL, you know, you play teams around the world. You know, how do you see the ability to evaluate players in the NTDP compared to leagues like college or like those in the CHL?
Yeah, no, that's another great question. I think the beauty that we have is we get to do it all, right? So we have players who are underage players playing in the USHL between 16 through 20. And then when they go play an international event, they play their own age group. And then they troubleshoot and go back to playing 16 to 20. And then the 18 year, they're doing that same thing as well as playing colleges. And some colleges could have players up to 24 years old.
Yeah.
You know, so we're playing against men. So we get to play between 16 and 20 like they do in the CHL. But then also we go and play international events where you play your own age. And then when we play colleges, we're playing against men. And at the end of the day, you know, when you get to the NHL, it doesn't matter what age you are. You know, it just matters if you're prepared and are you ready to play there. And you're playing against men. So I think our development model actually helps our players have success, because once they kind of get into a habit of playing their own age and playing, you know, guys that are a little younger than them, they have to then take the step to play against older guys, because wherever you go from here on out, the best players, no matter the age, but being a younger guy, they're going to be older than you.
Yeah.
Bigger, faster, stronger.
I think it's safe to say that. You're going to be one of the younger players in the NHL when you step into the league as well. So, good point.
Yeah, absolutely. Listen, Quinn Hughes is doing really well right now. Obviously, I know he's not a king. Sorry to bring up someone else. But, you know, he's had experience playing against older guys, not only just at Michigan, but even before that playing at the program. So it helps. You know, a lot of people are like, oh, look what he's done, you know, in such a short time. But if you look at the past four years he's had experience playing up against bigger, stronger, faster men in top competition.
So you're, as I mentioned, the assistant director of player personnel at the program. You know, a lot of your job is, you know, evaluating talent, you know, getting an understanding of, you know, who has the potential to move up and so on and so forth. So I'm going to, you know, go through a good chunk of these guys, hope to get a little bit of a, you know, need to know info on these guys or a scouting report. Sound like a plan?
Yeah, absolutely.
Awesome. So the first one I want to go with is Thomas Bordalo. You know, he was the leading scorer for the program this past year. Little undersized. What are we thinking about this guy?
You know what? Thomas Bordalo has a ton of skill. He's a skilled player. I think that his skill set might be one of the best on our team this past season. He can actually take face-offs. He's a left-handed player. He can actually take face-offs on the right-hand side as a righty. He turns his stick over, and he wins the draw on his opposite hands, and he has a high success rate doing it. So, you know, he's a really good skater, good edges. He's not a guy that exerts a lot of energy. He's not flying up and down the ice. He plays a little bit of a methodical game, but he jumps in areas when he needs to be. But his skill level is really, really high.
Just to go back to this face-off situation, I feel like the one person I can recall doing this would be Claude Giroux. Is there anyone else at that age that you've ever seen take this to that level?
I haven't. You know, I've seen someone try it here and there, and I've seen guys try it in practice. But this is something that he's mastered, and he does it all the time, and he wins draws. Like, he's won big draws in the defensive zone doing it, as well as in the offensive zone. You know, his dad is a player development coach for the Nashville Predators. So he gets to work on a lot of those skills, but he's getting taught really, really good info from his father, who's dealing with players at the highest level. Yeah. But it's impressive to see.
Yeah. So let's move on to the next one here. Ty
Smolanik.
This one's a little interesting. I was doing some research on him, and one of the players that he was compared to was the Kings' very own Jeff Carter. I was wondering if you think that's a fair comparison, and you know, where would you go in terms of talking about his hockey IQ? Because that's definitely something that people like.
Yeah, you know what? Ty plays really fast. He's a good skater. He's quick. He can jump in and out of areas. He was probably one of our fastest skaters. Jeff Carter is more of a power forward sniper. Ty did play the flank on the power play, and he can shoot the puck. But I would compare Ty to a player who can play at high speed, you know, and he has a scoring knack and he has skill. You know, Ty is going to be a really good addition to Quinnipiac, where he can go and get coached, because I think Rand Pecknold does a really good job, but also where he can go somewhere and be one of the guys early. Right. So he's going to go somewhere where he's relied on early, which is huge for his development.
So the Kings have, you know, 3 second-round picks and 2 thirds. And any of these guys, now that we're getting into, could go anywhere between the second and the third or fourth round, so to speak. So, you know, you look at the next one here, and I'm going to go to Tyler Cleven, the defenseman. You know, he's a bigger guy, especially at this age. Not a guy who put up a lot of points last year, but seemingly had a lot of effect on the outcome of the games in other ways.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I love Cleven. You know what? He's a physical presence. He's a physical presence. He has a little old school in him where he can throw hip checks and he can make the big open ice hits. But he also has some offensive awareness as well. I mean, for a big, you know, left-handed shot defenseman who's 6'4", like, he has a good skill set for that size. His feet are good. I think that for him, he's also going to North Dakota, where he's going to play the exact same way or that he has to play in the to make it to the NHL. So it's going to help him develop more and continue to do the things that he's done the past 2 seasons here. But I think Cleven is a guy who, you know what, he might get picked at the end of the first round. I wouldn't be shocked if someone, you know, took a chance on him at the end of the first round between picks 25 to 32.
Mm. Interesting. And now we're going to go from, you know, North Dakota to their old school rival in a player that's going to be going to Minnesota. Brock Faber, a guy who, you know, a little bit like a McAvoy is how he would describe himself and what he looks up towards. But described as a high character guy, you know, what's your definition of, you know, him being a high character player? And, you know, what do you see in his game?
Yeah, no, Brock's a great, great person, first and foremost, but he's a transitional puck mover. He really sees the ice well. He can get up into the play. He does all the little things right. He does have high character. You know, Brock made the choice to leave Minnesota and come join our program because he knew it was best for his hockey development. But Brock has a special needs sister at home, and he's close with her. And it was hard for him personally to leave Minnesota because of that relationship with his sister. And now he's going back to play college hockey there. But, you know, Brock is a great kid on and off the ice. He's more of a silent worker. He's not a big rah-rah guy, but he kind of leads by example. But he's a good transitional puck mover. He's going to be able to really make an impact in Minnesota. Obviously, Bob Moskow and Garrett Reboin, their newer coaches there. So they're starting to now kind of get some of their recruits in. So he's going to be able to make an impact there at the Big Ten.
So the next one we're going with is left wing. You know, obviously it's a name that USA is very familiar with, and Alex Tuck. So Luke Tuck, his brother, now a guy who's projected to go, you know, mid second, maybe early third, give or take a little bit. A little feistier, maybe not as much finish, but, you know, all in all, you know, what do you see in Luke Tuck's game moving forward?
Yeah, he's a power forward. He's tough to play against, but he's got a good stick where he can get into those scoring areas and be a threat all over the ice. I think he reminds me of a little bit of Brady Tkachuk. He may not skate as well as Brady, but he has that hard nose. He can be a pest. He loves to kind of be a thorn in the side, so to say, for the other team. And it drives his game. You know, like he's not a guy who does, you know, stupid stuff to take bad penalties or anything, but he can mix it up there and it's a part of his game and he doesn't mind doing it.
Sam Colangelo, you know, 6'2", 205, right winger. Do you see him as a power forward, more skill set? What do you see in his game and where do you expect him to go?
So Sam Colangelo played on Chicago Steel. He's from Lawrence Academy. I didn't get to see him as much this year as I had in the past, but he's taken some steps. You know, I think Chicago, they've done a really good job with their program and bringing guys in and getting them better. But I haven't seen him too much. But I know that, you know, he's a Northeastern commit and he's taken some huge strides and he's, you know, looked at to be in the top two, three rounds this draft.
So we're going to go back to a defenseman here, shade under 6 foot, you know, Eamon Powell, had a few more points than some of the other defensemen that we've already mentioned. One thing that stuck out to me and everything that I was looking up is he was looked at as potentially the best skater in the draft. Agree or disagree? And how far can that take him as he tries to develop the other parts of his game?
Yeah, no, Eamon has great feet. And he can defend with his feet. I know there's a lot of questions in size when you talk about defensemen, but he has great feet and he can use his feet well to defend. And the NHL is a game that keeps getting faster and faster as each season goes by. And you need that transitional speed. He's an offensive defenseman. He's good on the power play. He actually, as a defenseman, was our best guy in shootouts.
Really?
You know, he's done incredibly well. You know, we went to a long shootout in the 17 year where he actually shot as the third shooter. And then when we went into sudden death, you could pick the same shooter. He went two more times.
TJ Oshie.
Yeah. Yeah. It was TJ Oshie, Troy Terry-esque, and he was our defenseman. No, you know what? Another great kid. And, you know, his younger brother is coming into our program as of 2004. No, Eamon's going to be good. He's a power play guy, but his feet are incredible.
So now we're going to go back up to forward, and we've probably got, I think, if not the biggest kid on your team, but definitely the tallest forward in Dylan Peterson. Big centerman, 25 points this past year in 45 games, 6'4", 192. Definitely room to grow within the body. He's heading to BU next year, but, you know, where do you see his game in terms of developing towards the pro levels? I know his stock did drop a little bit among the draft rankings as the year went on. Not sure if you can give us a little reasoning on why, but why would a team want to draft him?
Yeah, I think Petey's underrated. I'm not sure why his stock dropped. You know, I think before Petey came to the program, he had played some D and then he transitioned to forward. And then he had played in a hockey academy. And he was one of the better players there, and the competition might have not have been as strong as some of the other players who were coming in that they were competing against. So he made some adjustments, but I think Petey has made some of the biggest strides on that team. I would say him and Brett Berard have made some of the biggest strides out of all the players there. I think Petey's a big guy, righty with skill, like you said. He could skate. I love that he's going to play at BU where he's going to be able to play a hard-nosed game where he has to kind of be tough, have a roll down low, keep plays alive, but also he's going to play, you know, in Hockey East where there are a lot of skilled players. So he's going to get to do a little bit of both because for his size, he does have good skill. So he'll kind of get to continue to develop and do both those components. And hopefully it'll translate for him to get a chance to play pro.
You just mentioned him, and it leads me right into my last player here on our list with Brett Berard. From the tallest player in your team in Peterson to the shortest player in your team at the 150-pound, 5'8½" left winger in Berard. Undersized, obviously, but skilled. You know, very Brad Marchand-esque is what a lot of people have been saying. He plays with an edge. Also one of the youngest players in this year's draft. You know, talk to me about Berard.
Yeah, I think one of the biggest things that we can't measure, you know, analytics, you know, I like analytics to a certain point, but I think one of the biggest things you can't measure is inner drive. And I would say that ever since Brett stepped foot here in the program, he was one of the last committed players to that O2 team. But he didn't treat it that way. He came in, he knew what he had to do. He put his head down and he worked. You know, it wasn't an easy road for him by any means. Our coaches pushed him and they were hard on him. His father's a college hockey coach. You know what? But I give Brett all the credit in the world because he showed up every day with a positive attitude and elite inner drive to work his hardest and to soak up the coaching. He didn't reject the coaching. He just came in, soaked up coaching, and he's taking massive strides because of that. You know, we tell players to be comfortable being uncomfortable. You know, that's a saying that's said a lot, and he embraced that. And, you know, it's starting to show that people are recognizing his talent.
Now, the last thing I want to do here is I'm going to put you on the spot a little bit. You know, you look through, you know, a number of different mock drafts, and, you know, now that the Kings have Robo on staff, you know, there's a high chance or at least a likely chance that his input is going to be very involved in the potential ability to take players at the program and bring them in as a Kings draft pick. You know, I'm going to ask you to put your GM hat on here. You know, you take into consideration, you know, Robo's coaching style and maybe his input, you know, what you saw personally from these players and ultimately the direction that the Kings are going. You know, who would you predict is most likely to end up in a Kings uniform or a Kings to be heard by the Kings on draft day?
What are the picks again? What number?
So we've got 35, we've got late 50s, give or take 60, and then we've got early third and mid third. So there's a lot of them.
You put me on a spot here. I would definitely say Tyler.
Forget numbers. Yeah, no. With what you've, you know, style, fit, think, mindset, etc.
Yeah, no, for sure. I think if Tyler Cleven is still there, that's definitely someone who could transition into having success under Robo as well as being a really good pick for the LA Kings. He's big, he's mobile, you know, he's not a prototypical defenseman at that size. He has good skill. So as much as we talk about how fast the game has gone, you look at the NHL playoffs, you got to be strong. Yep. You know, and there's still some guys that are out there that are big, and it's a tough game. So I definitely think Cleven is one. I'm going to say that here's one that's off the board that you didn't ask about, and I would say Landon Slaggart.
Okay.
Landon Slaggart's another one. He's just he's not a flashy player. He's a very efficient player. He does all the little things right. He's a leader. His character is extremely high. And he was a really, really big catalyst for that team that we had, along with Matty Beniers, who's not in this draft. But I would say Tyler Cleven, Landon Slaggart, and I'll go Brett Berard.
Brett Berard. Well, I think in that aspect, you've covered all sizes and shapes. So, Rod, I appreciate the time. Thanks for making the call, and best of luck at the program this next year, and stay safe.
Thanks for having me, Jack. I appreciate it.
John Robleski, new head coach of the Ontario Reign, is our guest on today's Rainy Day podcast. John, how you doing?
Doing well. How are you guys doing?
Pretty good. So, you know, some big news earlier in the week, second head coach in Ontario Reign history. What was it about this Ontario Reign job that was the right fit for you?
Well, the intrigue came, you know, you could see it coming a few years ago when the Kings started to acquire picks, and then, you know, the picks were utilized to acquire really good players, and then you could start to see things start to develop there. And, you know, there's a bonus here that it's in Southern California, but it really is the pool of prospects that it was the ultimate, you know, focus for me. And it was, you know, actually a bit of a bullseye, to be honest. You could say, oh my God, if they ever get involved with that LA team would be something special. You know, what they have being built. And so, you know, it's been a couple of years in the making for me, actually eyeing this prospect pool up. And then of course they selected one of my players, Alex Turcotte, last summer, with the fifth overall pick. And so, you know, Turks is a really strong player, one of my favorites. And so the intrigue started to build and build.
Hey, John, it's Jesse Cohen here. You brought it up, but I have to ask. I'm sure it's not as simple as this, but was Turcotte the sort of straw that broke the camel's back? Was that the thing that put you over the top on the decision?
No, and I think, you know, even at various times, it could even be looked as a, you know, not a detrimental piece to it, but, you know, you'd never want an 18-year-old coming in, 19-year-old coming in to be favored or anything like that. So I think that, you know, Alex's development, I don't want to say that I didn't have a hand in it, but he is the type of player that can kind of flourish in a lot of different environments. He's just has so many tools, and he's so dedicated to his trade. So I think that Alex, you know, was a very, very small part of the equation. But the one thing that I would say is the way that he led the team, the way that he played, could be, you know, an exemplary piece of what we were looking for, and then kind of, you know, helped establish culture. And that's a huge part of coaching, I think, in general, is that you draw inspiration from the players, and the players, of course, need to be inspired by the coaching staff and management. But, you know, a player like Alex can make your team look really good, and also gives you teaching points to work on with your players. So, you know, you take the brilliance of a Trevor Zegras or Jack Hughes, Cole Caulfield, you know, any of those big names that kind of went in the first round there. You take their brilliance, and then you try to, you know, if you observe it, you can kind of push it on to the other guys around you and use them as exemplary pieces of what you're looking for on and off the ice. So there's Alex is a part of that equation for sure. But, you know, I think there's a lot of things that go into landing a job like the one that the Reign offered.
With the NTDP, your class with Turcotte, with Zegras and Hughes, like you mentioned, so many first-round talent, so many high-level prospects, which is similar to the group of players you'll likely be working with in Ontario this season. How did you go about managing, you know, all those high-level players? Like, they can't all play on the first line. They can't all play on the power play. Is it a good problem to have, or can it be challenging to maybe make a first-line talent into a guy who can play on a third line?
Well, you know, there's a lot of moving pieces there, and I think that to make all the players happy on any given team, it takes the coach to acknowledge their value, to acknowledge their strengths, try to bolster those as much as possible, and then also, you know, tell them straight up if they have weaknesses, and we all do in some way, shape, or form. We all have some weaknesses, and how you deliver it to each person, I think, is unique, that they need to work on something, or they need to change something, or just tweak something. And it was a tremendous challenge of balancing personalities, when to give, you know, a kid like Trevor Zegras a hard shot that, hey, this is what needs to happen, or give somebody else, you know, maybe just a slight, you know, tap on the back, or, you know, a nudge forward that you can do this, and you can, you know, you can be better than this. You know, there, I can't imagine a sequence where, you know, there's going to be a scenario and that all four center icemen from one team get selected in the first round again. But what a challenge, and, you know, unique personalities and skill sets. And I think massive for development going forwards. And you know, I've been in some circles before, and then you know that you know there's worry about you know, ego, or you know, how do you balance it out with there's only one puck. And it's just making sure everybody feels valued in what they do. And they all are, their work away from the puck, their work on the puck. If you're a one-timer guy, you know, all those, everybody's value is there. Some guys are highlighted a little bit more in the media, but, you know, what happens behind closed doors, with the team meetings, the forward meetings, the individual meetings, that's where you cultivate belief in your team, and the individuals.
We're going to go on a complete U-turn here. It's been a good start, yep. But we're going to swip it around here. I'm going to ask, do you like being called coach?
No, I'd prefer Robo is the way that I go here. So, if we could just switch that up. Yeah. Nobody really calls me by a first name or coach. So
we go with Robo. That works, but leads good. You into, we always try to work a would you rather into these podcasts, kind of break the ice here early. And the way you answer that question is going to set up which would you rather I used. Because if you didn't mind it, it would kind of throw this one out of the water. But here's the would you rather for the day. Jesse, I'll rephrase it a little bit for you to answer as well. Would you rather only be called coach for the rest of your life? No one will call you John. No one will call you Robo. Everyone calls you coach. Or for the next year, you have to have a unibrow. You can shave it. Day 366, you can shave it. But day 1 through 365, you got a unibrow.
Is Jesse supposed to answer this?
Nobody calls me coach.
For Jesse, I'll angle it to you as everyone is going to call you, you know, like you're the Kingsman podcast guy. No one will ever call you by your name. It's like, oh, it's Kingsman podcast. Someone's going to refer to you.
For the rest of my life?
Rest of your life, or the unibrow for 1 year.
Is this family members too?
Everyone you ever speak to again.
I guess I'll take the unibrow then.
Nobody calls me John anyways, so it doesn't matter. Even when my wife's trying to get my attention from the first floor to the second floor, I don't hear John, but if she yells Robo, I hear it every time. So, that doesn't happen very often. I'm usually a quite attentive husband, so that's a rarity. So. But no, it's definitely coach and Robo for a year over the unibrow. I don't even think I could grow one though. I got kind of blonde eyebrows here, so it wouldn't even fill in. But whatever, we'll work around it.
That's like a sneaky cop out. You could just grow the blonde unibrow. No one wouldn't even show up in like photos or video.
Robo, I hate to name drop so early in our knowing each other, but. I asked Barry Melrose earlier this year if I should call him coach or not, because I was talking to him. I'd never met him before, and I just found myself calling him Barry, and it felt wrong. So I said, like, oh, man, do I call you coach? And he said, American kids call him coach, and Canadian kids call him Barry. I'm wondering if you've noticed a similar difference the way players talk to the coaches.
No, and it's always Robo. It's, you know, I guess when you're dealing – when you deal with a 16-year-old kid and he first comes in, then he's, you know, terrified of you and your coach. And I think there's some respect level too, that some players still call you that, even though, you know, when you call them up or you text with them, then it's Robo. But it, you know, it's sometimes they, you know, it's calling somebody Mr. as opposed in front of the right, crowd, you know, just addressing people with respect. So sometimes the players will throw out coach, but in the pro circuit, no one's ever called me coach. It's always Robo. And that's how it works. You're working together. There's no real, you know, of course they're looking for you for direction and leadership, but at the same time, I can't reiterate enough how the players and the staff, they all integrate and they all rely on each other equally. And there's, That's why I think in pro dressing rooms that it's always a nickname referring to the coach.
So your time with the NTDP, it goes back a while, you know, not just to your head coaching, not just to your assistant coaching, but you remember the first ever NTDP class as a player. And what was it like joining that program that was completely unknown? Like right now it's so highly regarded, but back when you joined, you were kind of going into an unknown. Like, what was that process like?
Completely unknown. I mean, it was because it was pre-internet too. So that's almost, it's hard to fathom that you learn about this with now what it's growing to become. You learned about this through, it was like USA Hockey or even a Michigan hockey magazine that I had happened to stumble across. And it was like late December, early January of when I was 15 years old that they were going to be picking this team in a couple of months. And I was actually, I signed a tender with another team in the North American Hockey League. So a domestic junior league here in the U.S., one below our top league, the USHL. I'd signed a tender with Danville, the Danville Wings. And a week before the tryout for the NTDP, my dad just happened to track somebody down from USA Hockey, just said, "Hey, I know you guys are having this tryout. I got this kid. We haven't heard anything from you. He's about to sign a tender with this team in the NAHL. Is there any interest from you guys? Cause he would do anything to play for the USA." And, whoever answered the phone and says, "Hey, let me hang up here and call you back." And later on that day, they called him back, and I was on a plane to Detroit a week later for the tryout camp, and I ended up making the team. So that's kind of like just a bit of a microcosm of how far we've traveled as a program. And now it's just such a well-oiled machine, and the scouting staff that's there and the facilities are second to none. And back then we showed up and they were still building the facility, and we were dressing in an empty locker room type of space. There was no hooks, no stalls, nothing. We showed up and the locker room wasn't ready until January of our first year. So it was a really interesting experience. But you know, the pride that the group of guys that started off in Ann Arbor at the time, we still have a great text message string with a number of guys from that inaugural class.
A lot of players, that went on to play pro hockey in that group too. And you go from the U.S., the NTDP, you go on to Notre Dame, play NCAA hockey there. We had another Notre Dame alum on, Cal Peterson, at the beginning of the season, and he told us that Notre Dame hockey flies exclusively charter. And I want to know if that was the case when you played there as well.
Yeah, exclusive charter buses back and forth to Omaha and all over the rest of the CCHA at the time. No. We hardly ever flew. I mean, and when I say that we took buses to Nebraska, we did. Way different era of college hockey. We used to, your rivals back then, we didn't play Wisconsin the whole 4 years I was there. And now they play them, I think, four or five or six times a season. Our rivals were Ferris State and Western Michigan, Bowling Green. It was regional. Of course, Michigan and Michigan State were in the old CCHA. And I really liked the old format. I thought that it was a very, very true college experience where, you've got some of these bigger schools coming into the quote unquote smaller market of Ferris State I don't want to belittle Bowling Green because of course our brass has they won national championships there and did a heck of a job, but they did go through a lull there for a little bit. And but I loved going into the smaller rinks. I thought that the fan bases were so passionate, and I thought that it made for a really, really organic experience of college hockey. And I, of course, money drives a lot of things. And the Big Ten is a tremendous opportunity for television and to get a lot of notoriety for the sport. So you have to acknowledge that. But I really, really enjoyed those regional battles and what that meant and how much everybody cared about it.
Zach, I feel like I'm letting the podcast down. Robo Cameron Close, the usual co-host of the podcast, is known for his partisan vitriol when it comes to talking college hockey, and I just don't share.
He asked me if you could send a couple more players to the University of New Hampshire from the NTDP. He feels they've been slighted with those players. It's his alma mater.
Yeah, they're well committed before I see these guys or see those guys anymore. They're committed at 14, 15 years old. The entire scope of college hockey's changed, and I really respect college hockey, but I'm very, very comfortable in the pro ranks, and I think that That's always been my calling and where I've wanted to go. And, you know, it couldn't tell you how happy I am to land with the Kings in Southern California.
I want to talk to you real quick about your age, because it was one of the first things that leapt out to me when I had heard that you were in consideration to be hired. And I said, 39 years old. Wow, I've gotten used to players being younger than me. It took me a while, but I finally wrapped my head around it. But I think this is the first time the organization has hired a coach that's younger than me, not by much. But you and I, Robo, are Xennials, which is apparently a micro generation in between Gen X and Millennials, like Zach. And what differentiates us is that we grew up without the internet, but now that we're adults, we have had the internet for most of, if not all of our adult life, right? We were born on that wave crashing on the world. So I'm curious, you had the experience of going through these programs, going through the NDDB and college without, you know, smartphones in everybody's hand, without social media, but now you're charged with coaching a generation of kids that grew up with it and have, you know, probably four or five different social media accounts and can bypass the front office and the PR departments and, you know, have these relationships with fans. How do you wrap your head around, you know, dealing with a generation that grew up in a completely different way than you did? Well, maybe not completely different, but different in that regard.
Completely different. you embrace the change and, yeah, I thought you were going to go a different direction with how you and I were connected to a different you know, kind of classification. I didn't know we were going into a millennial zone, but I thought you were going to kind of go down the line of maybe you know, a sign. And as a Gemini, I don't really read into this too often, but I have been told that you're a bit of a chameleon and that you can wear a couple of different hats at different times. And you know, there's definitely a side of me that shows quite a bit of seriousness at times and harshness, and that usually is around the game of hockey. But there's actually a complete flip side of me that really enjoys a good time and a good laugh. And I think that you embrace the change and you acknowledge it, or you know, for lack of a better phrase, you perish along with that, the change, because it's coming. And frankly, I've always been intrigued by, you know, it used to be kind of like you would be classified into different, maybe 5 or even 10 year generations of hockey player. They talk about like pre-lockout or, you know, the post-lockout or the '80s type of player. Or the, you know, the left wing lock or the trap, you were kind of in that era of player. And what I've noticed coming through the NTDP is that there's not as much era of players anymore. It's every year they really change. There's a new platform out there, whether you want to, you know, start with Instagram, go there, and then it evolves to TikTok. The kids are, they like it. And they enjoy it, and you better embrace what they enjoy and what's happening. And, you know, hopefully what you can do is tie in your experiences. And I've had a lot of them. I've scaled a lot of different generations of hockey players coming up. And I think that, you know, going forward, hopefully I'm strong enough in my roots and my convictions to be able to maintain those changes and embrace that, you know, the differentiation between each year and each type of player that's coming through, and still be able to connect with them on a personal basis, because I can't reiterate enough how important that trust and connective tissue is to building a player and getting the most out of the individual, which, you know, if you guys, I know you've read up a bunch, but if you cultivate the individual on each team and make them the best you can possibly make them on and off the ice, eventually what you can do is cultivate your team into being the best that they can be. So kind of, you know, sum of all parts type of mantra.
I still get offended, Jesse, anytime anyone calls me a millennial. I like I know that I do fall into that boat, but like, I just hate it. I don't know. Like, it's negative.
Well, it's a derogatory, frequently used as a derogatory phrase, right?
It is. It's just, you know, it defines an age group, which I think I fall into, but I still hate it.
I'll never do it again.
There we go. Yeah. But no, I mean, you're right, in a way, like, you know, you connect with, you know, Brett Sutter
a lot differently than you connect with, say, you know, Tobias Bjornfoot, just from two guys who were on the team last year. It just goes to show in the AHL, you know, there's so many different, there are guys who fall into those different buckets still, even though at the end of the day, they're still, you know, they're all hockey players. But
right. Yeah. I talked to Sutsy right after the press conference on Monday. I wanted to reach out to him immediately and, you know, start that. And, you know, he was out in Viking off coming over from Calgary, and he was at the farm all day. And I don't think that, you know, that's obviously a throwback type of player and mentality, but there's not a lot of guys out there like that anymore that really, you know the, know that workman type mentality. And so there's a different generation of player here. And, you know, it's a job of a manager and I guess, you know, a coach will say, and to bind all personalities together and to draw the best out of each type of kid and where he's from and on the planet.
I think Sutz is as good as they come, as most in this organization will tell you, you know, even just being with the Rain. But so I was doing a little research on you the other day, and I stumbled across FresnoFalcons.com. Now, this team folded in 2008, but their website is still active, and you are still featured on the website as a player.
And what's the question?
I don't know. I just needed to bring that up, is that I stumbled across, there's like this rotating thing of players. And I saw John Robleski up at the top, playing day's headshot.
I spent 4 years in Fresno and as a player, and you know, it was interesting how that came to be. And I went to training camp with Vancouver back when with them in 2003, right after I graduated from school. And, you know, rightfully so, smartly, Brian Burke decided to give me my passing papers. And I ended up snagging on with Cleveland in the American Hockey League. And Cleveland's affiliate happened to be the Fresno Falcons. And when there became a logjam in Cleveland, I was shipped out to California to start my pro hockey career. And I had no idea what was what. I didn't know where Fresno was. Again, a little bit pre-internet, there was what would it have been, MapQuest, I believe, at the time was how I printed out my directions to get to California. And so ended up driving, you know, you get start to go through Vegas, and then I stopped in LA to visit a couple friends from college that were that had moved down to Manhattan Beach after school. And so stopped there, and then I started heading north and started to run into a little bit of desert here and there. And next thing you know, I'm in Fresno. I'm in the middle of the state. So that's how I got there. And I think as a hockey player, you want to set up, you know, strong. You want to believe in yourself. You want to, you know, I can do this. I can make this work. And 4 years later, I'm still in the ECHL, and it was time to move on to another career. But I had a great run. Gave everything I had. Loved playing the game. Just flat out wasn't good enough. So that's about it. But, you know, the people of Fresno, the fans were great there. And, I had a great, my playing style was a little reckless and not as thoughtful as it was as a coach. And so I kind of worked out well with the fan base, because I worked hard and ran around and worked my butt off every game. So that kind of translates to the average fan.
Like, I spent 3 years in the ECHL myself, and when you've been in that league, you know that there's pretty much every degree of, you know, levels in that league. There's the franchises that are run very well, and there's the franchises that you can't believe are still in business. And you stayed in Fresno for 4 years. What was it about there that, you know, made you keep going back? Because I'm sure that you could have, if you wanted to, even if you're an ECHL player, you could have gone somewhere else if you wanted to.
Well, you know, I think it has something to do with the type of person I am. I think that, you know, I'm gonna push on, and I can make this work type of thing. And you know, you keep getting qualified. They can only qualify an X amount of players, and so to walk in and to tell somebody that you want to trade or to say I want out of here. I think that takes there's a lot of things that must go into that, and that wasn't me. And you know, that never really was part of my fabric. And so I think that's probably the best answer I can give you. It really was. And we had three coaching changes too when I was there. So there was some new beginnings to have. There was some familiarity, but also new beginnings. So I think maybe if you're in a situation, you've got the same coach and it's not going the right way, you're not getting the call. But I felt like, and this was the truth too, is I felt like I was getting better because I did work really hard and on and off the ice to make myself a better player. So it's not like I never felt like I wasn't getting opportunity or feeling better. So honestly, I love playing, and I didn't think too much about why I wasn't getting the call up. I just kept coming to the rink and doing my job. So a little bit different mentality I had as a player, than as a coach. I'm a little bit more, forward thinking and, you know, analytical here, at this point.
You make your way back into the ECHL as a coach eventually, and any man who survived a year in Wheeling, West Virginia, you know, has got to be a little bit hardened, I think.
Don't even think about talking about my folks in the wheel like this. Do not put them down, Zach. They are good folks over there. I love my year there. Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, but no, Wheeling has actually, you know, been pretty successful, to be honest. But, you know, as you do transition into coaching, you know, you're with the NTDP as an assistant, Wheeling as an assistant, Gwinnett as a head coach. What was that transition like? And was it helpful for you to be an assistant first before you got your first head coaching job with the Gladiators?
Yeah, I think Wheeling at the time had the most NHL call-ups ever. And I would bet that they're still around there. So Pittsburgh always, and Wilkes-Barre always leaned on the ECHL particularly for goalies, but even for position players. You know, the location was really probably the turning point for that, being able to send guys down and get a little more ice time or whatever it was. But as far as my career's gone in the coaching ranks, I've been very, very fortunate to be able to observe, maybe take a jump, and then also then step back for a second and observe again, and then take another jump in and observe. It's been very cyclical that way. So I started off as an intern coach at the NTDP, and then after 1 year of being able to kind of watch everything that went on there, I got promoted to a primary assistant job. So obviously more responsibility. And from there, you jump to Wheeling assistant. You jump into the head coach in that league. Now it's a lot more responsibility. Jump to an assistant in the American League, step back, you know, kind of, you know, see everything from 10,000 feet. You're not managing as much. You're able to take in the information, take in what you like, what you don't like, what you change, what you do if you were ever in the big seat. And then fortunate enough to land back at the NTDP, which is, you know, again, see everything that you've gone on, and then really be able to take everything you've learned from the different leagues and experiences, and then pour it back into the development process of making, you know, the nation's best players their best on and off the ice. And that leads us to today, you know, with the Ontario Reign is making that jump again. So I've had an opportunity to look at the American League and look at the National League from a different scope the last four seasons. Still keep up to date with all my coaching friends and you know, connections in the big league and the American League. And you know, now it's an opportunity to take said knowledge and go apply it to a real situation.
When Todd McClellan was hired as a head coach of the Kings, he made a point of saying that he didn't want to hear from the coaches, the assistant coaches that were returning. He didn't want to hear from the front office. He didn't want any input on who the players were, what kind of game they played. He wanted to form his own opinion before soliciting advice and opinions from other people. I'm not sure how much turnover there will be in the Reign roster, but there's sure to be some players coming back. I'm curious if you'll have the same approach that he did, or if you'll lean heavily on the assistant coaches that were here last season.
Yeah, I wouldn't say that it's a different view. It might just be Todd's experiences far surpass anything that I've ever done before, and I'm going to lean a lot on the organization. What player development feels, what the assistants think, what upper management, where they want things to go. There's a learning process to be had here. I don't expect to come in and form my own opinions about anything immediately. I'd like this to be a gradual experience where I come in, I see what we've got, I listen. When it comes time to the hockey, I'll make as strong judgment as I possibly can at that second, in that instance, so that we can act quickly and decisively. But as far as information, I believe that it's necessary for me at this point of my coaching career, and my spot, my place in the organization, to learn as much as I possibly can. There's a learning curve to be had here, and I'm ready to take it on it's definitely a daunting task, but one that I'm really excited about, and I've, to this point, I've been a quick learn. I've been able to acclimate to most scenarios, and I expect, you know, that's the expectation that I put on myself, and of course the organization has as well.
Any idea how much input you'll have on filling that final assistant coaching role?
The organization has certain criteria that they believe in, and I'm completely on board with it. I think that at this point we'll work hand in hand, but there's some quality candidates that have already been set up, and I'm a big believer in all of them right now.
Last question I had for you is, in Rob Blake's remarks on Monday with your hiring, he mentioned that you'll be tasked with, you know, developing players as much as you will be with winning hockey games. And, you know, for those who've been around the AHL, the 18, 19 year old first round picks aren't always necessarily, you know, your top end players. Whereas sometimes it's the 25 year old guy who's a 14th forward in the NHL kind of player who's leading the league in scoring. And how do you view the balance between getting those younger prospects into key situations versus playing your older guys, you know, in key moments as well to try and win those games?
So much of development, in my experience, happens away from the games. It's how they practice. It's the type of things you do in practice. The best players on the planet might touch the game or might touch the puck for a minute in any given game. Most players aren't going to have the puck on their stick for more than 15 to 20 seconds, legitimately, in any given game. So they get better through practice. Now, this is a really, really dynamic answer. So that being said, we're going to push them in practice. We're going to get extremely creative. We're going to put them up and down the ice as fast as we can. They're going to be put into tons of situations where they're put into game-like scoring spots where they have to manage breakdowns, where they get to take advantage of breakdowns, where they're expected to, you know, go out and apply the skills that they've inherited as athletes, and then we help bolster said skills. This carries over to off the ice. Their individual video, the care that we as a staff give the players, that is where the true development takes place, in my opinion. And I think that that's something that I've been pretty clear with throughout the interview process. Now, that being said, as a competitor, once the puck drops, that's when it's on. And I, just because we practice really hard and we ask things of the players that they may have never been asked to do, particularly in the pro game, in practice, once that puck drops on Friday, Saturday, Wednesday, Sunday afternoon, whenever that puck drops, it's game on, and we expect them to live up to certain habits and certain ideals that the team, you know, will put into place. Once again, this is all in conjunction with upper management's vision, and slowly but surely we will become the team that we want to become in Ontario, with the right amount, right mixture, and then of course the right decision making at the proper times by the coaching staff. And so, very, very long-winded answer, but it's not as simple as deciding to develop or to win. And those items, I believe, and what I've realized and what I've owned at the NTDP, is that both of those things can happen. And you know, we need to have a lot of good habits to win. And those are cultivated over time, and the systems have to be adhered to, and those are cultivated over time. But number one focus, and I believe this, the organization is on the same page, and we're all going forward with this, is to develop, make sure that we don't give up a day, that every day these guys come to the rink and are getting challenged and are getting better. And that goes back to that individual one by one. We make the individual better. Some of our parts becomes a team, and then the team has the ultimate success. We build into that pack mentality eventually, where guys really start playing for each other and, you know, doing the little things that everybody talks about that end up being the big things, the differentiating points of blocking shots and, you know, doing the things that only are acknowledged behind closed doors. So hopefully I didn't go over time there, but I could probably talk about the difference between development and winning all day long. I believe in hand, there's a right and a wrong way to win hockey games. To me, I like to dominate all facets. I want the scoring chances to be tilted heavily in our favor. I want us flying to spots. I don't want us hesitating. I don't want our goaltender. I want our goaltender to make 40 saves, but I don't want that to be a normal situation. I like to dominate games. I like where our players are playing for each other, that everybody's backing each other up and everybody knows each other's job. And all that comes through to me developing the individual to know what's demanded of him within the team structure.
It was a complex question, so I think a long-winded answer is appropriate. And you showed at the NTDP that those two things can go hand in hand. So we look forward to seeing that in Ontario as well. And Robo, thanks for coming on with us. That's all I have. Anything else, Jesse?
No, I'm good. Thanks, Robo.
Yeah, you bet, Zach. Thanks, Jesse. Really appreciate the time and another great conversation, getting the juices flowing. I don't need a whole lot of that right now. I'm pretty excited to get out there, but we're stoked to get out to SoCal.
Look forward to seeing you out there, hopefully sometime soon.
You bet.